You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why new technology is helping answer lingering questions about how tornadoes form.
First, every year, the University of Wisconsin Press hands out the Felix Pollack Prize in Poetry and the Brittingham Prize in Poetry. These awards recognize the two best book-length manuscripts of original poetry.
We're joined now by the winner of this year's Brittingham Prize in Poetry, Max Garland, is a retired professor of English literature at UW-Eau Claire and former poet laureate of Wisconsin. Max, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, congratulations, Max. Can you tell us about the award and what it means to have won it?
I suppose it means that the poems will see the light of day, which is what you eventually always want. And you hack away at them and you pile them up and you throw them away and you retrieve them. And then so having the book come out will just sort of increase the chances that maybe something I thought of and said will reach and maybe have meaning to someone else.
And you've said this collection is about a couple of strands, one of them being memory and how memory changes, and another about how hard it is to put a word on something. So how did those two themes come to life in this collection?
I used to think that I used to want to capture things accurately. I think that if I could only retrieve this moment in time, you know, the way it actually happened. And I think maybe it has to do with age or... But I now understand that you're always working on your memory. I mean, memory is a poem in progress, so to speak. And I've lost my ambition for accurately recapturing the past, but I've not lost my desire to sort of shape it into something useful and meaningful.
In a way, does that mean you're capturing it more accurately in a way because you're reflecting the way we actually remember?
Yes, I think so. I think you're seeing it from a different perspective, from a distance of time, and the meaning of it actually changes. And also, you know, it's not as if we experienced something wholly 100% back in the day when it actually happened to us. I mean, we were partly there and we were partly elsewhere.
And looking at the words, I mean, the poet's job is to work with words and to figure out which word will be most evocative of a particular feeling or story. Why is it so hard to pin a word down and make it do what you want it to do?
Because as amazing as language is, experience is not necessarily the same as language. And so there is often a gap between what we feel, what we experience, what we know about ourselves or suspect about ourselves, and the words that we find available to convey that. And that space, that distance, that is the terrain of poetry.
Talking to Max Garland, former poet laureate of Wisconsin, current writer in residence for the city of Eau Claire. Max, I understand you've got an excerpt from the book to read for us?
Yeah, I have a poem. I've just sort of left out a little bit of it, but it's the last poem in the book. But if I read this, it doesn't mean you don't have to buy the book.
You're giving away the ending.
Just because you know how it
Spoiler
is.
Spoiler alert.
Because it could have ended on a lot of other poems. But so here's my dubious proposal. This is the title of the poem. The best things in life are the most expensive. Grass, for instance, which shines with the wet light of morning and lines the bottoms of small baskets and valleys, costing all the way from the center of the sun, photons pinballing their way to the unfurling corona and then smack into the sheen on the face of the grass. And snowfall, which is the bread of heaven, though broken by the time it gets here, but lovely when wind-carved and shattered into spectral bits by low angles of light, and then training the pine branches to balance the snow, all expensive. And music, which took millions of years of birds and wolves and longing to learn. And words that well up and want to be, but nerve is missing and must be hunted up and down the corridors of the spine, separated out from the more plentiful cut-rate words that shine a little, but soon wreck or stick or cease to console. So expensive, hardly less than unaffordable, are the best things. Time and memory and forgetting. Water wearing over rocks that took half the life of the planet to form. And wishing you could hear it all more deeply and longer. And also silence.
Well, Max, thank you. That was beautiful. And what was the name of that poem one more time, please?
The best things in life are the most expensive.
The best things in life are the most expensive. And I sense, I mean, there's a lot going on in that poem, but maybe because I know that you're in Eau Claire and I've been there recently soaking in that landscape, I feel like I'm getting some images hitting me of the natural world. And I'm wondering how you incorporate that into your poetry and into this one in particular.
I think that, I'm within sight of the Chippewa River right now. I live within 2 blocks of the Eau Claire River. And so the cover of this particular book will be a scene of a snowstorm over the Eau Claire River. And I think that, well, living in Wisconsin, you better make some sort of negotiation or peace with the weather, or you're gonna have a long winter, you know. It's something that we have to endure, but hopefully learn to love as well.
There's talk lately about the role of arts and humanities in our culture now, especially with possible major cuts to federal funding for the arts and humanities. As you're watching there from Eau Claire, what's your reaction, Ben?
Well, watching from Eau Claire, which is a town that has sort of revitalized itself, is in the process of revitalizing its downtown based upon the arts, based upon private and public support for the arts, I say that there's a lot at stake here. Also, I think that it should be a matter of common sense that to take money from public education, from public support for the arts, is sort of doing our enemy's job for them. And I don't think we should do that. I think strengthening the amount of wisdom and imagination and creativity in young people and trying to articulate the deepest parts of ourselves is a source of national strength.
And will you be taking, you know, any sort of activism for that, or do you think that your poetry is what speaks to the value of the arts?
Well, I'm quite biased because I grew up in rural Western Kentucky with very little chance of going to college or becoming a poet, or certainly not becoming the poet laureate of Wisconsin. So I benefited from the latter of affordable and free public education. I had an NEA grant. I had Wisconsin arts grants. I wouldn't be here without that. So maybe I'm just saying I'm grateful and somebody gave me a ladder and I don't want to be a part of pulling that ladder up after me.
Can you talk about the value of poetry in our lives a little bit, even for people who aren't aiming to be poets themselves? Can you make the case that we should give it a shot, even if it's something we're not planning to share?
It's not. In a way, it seems alienating and strange, but anyone who's ever had a portion of a lyric of a song that they couldn't get out of their heads, who's ever attended a wedding or a funeral or any kind of ceremony and realized that some of the words seem to capture more than other words. Anyone who's ever felt the difference between who they knew themselves to be inside, what they really felt, and what they were able to say about it, knows what the need for poetry, knows where the impulse for poetry comes from. And my first book was published when I was 45. So I'm very much an advocate of late bloomers. And I would encourage anyone out there to understand that if you're listening to this, it's not too late.
Max, I read that you are reading really long books and writing song lyrics. Maybe it sounds like to get away from the technology that's everywhere. Can you talk about that effort and what you're trying to do?
We're inundated by language, by fragmented language, by sales pitch, by sound bites, by tweets. And that language is meant to wash over us and maybe stir up desire or fear or something. And so I worry about my own concentration. I worry about my own brain and soul. And I want to be able to sustain a thought. And I want to be able to use the capabilities and potentialities of language to do more, instead of just simply consume.
Max, thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on that award.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
That was Max Garland, former poet laureate of Wisconsin, current writer in residence for the city of Eau Claire. He recently received the Brittingham Prize in Poetry for the book The Word We Used for It. it's spring in Wisconsin, and that means tornado season is likely just around the corner.
The science of tornado prediction is still inexact. Tornadoes and the supercell storms that create them can pop up suddenly, and the tornadoes themselves move erratically and last for hugely different amounts of times, from minutes, sometimes even to hours.
Lee Orff is with us now. He leads a lab that's out to better understand and predict tornadoes using computer models at the Space Science and Engineering Center at UW-Madison. Lee, thanks so much for coming up to the studio.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, what are the big questions that scientists are still trying to answer about tornadoes?
Sure. So, you know, we're all familiar with run-of-the-mill thunderstorms that we see in Wisconsin. The vast majority we see last about 45 minutes and produce some rain, you know, keep the lawn green, things like that. We're not interested in those types of storms. We're looking at the storms that produce the biggest, nastiest tornadoes imaginable. And the questions that really remain are, what's going on inside those storms, right? What's going on inside the storms that produce the devastating long path, very, very, very bad tornadoes versus the storms that look very similar but don't produce those tornadoes? And that's the real question we're trying to get at here, so we can give better predictions.
Are there similar ingredients that, you know, they all come together, only sometimes you get a tornado and sometimes you don't? Do we know at least some of the fundamentals?
Yes, we do. That's a great question. So if you're looking for the ingredients for a supercell thunderstorm, which is defined as a thunderstorm with a rotating updraft that lasts a very long time, you need a few ingredients. You need what's called wind shear, which is the variation of horizontal winds with height in the atmosphere. You need instability, which is a measure of how conducive the atmosphere is to very large vertical motions, updrafts. You need moisture, humidity, and you need something to trigger the storm. When it comes to tornadic supercells, the ones that produce tornadoes, we're getting a better picture. You need some very concentrated wind shear near the ground, so you have winds varying very rapidly with height. So if you can imagine, for instance, very strong winds from the east at, say, 20 miles an hour near the ground, and maybe only a few hundred feet above that, you have winds from the southeast, and then from a few hundred feet above that, you have winds from the south. So you have this very, you know, the winds are turning with height. That seems to be a critical ingredient for getting really nasty tornadoes.
And the work you're doing, as I understand it, is pretty cutting edge in that some of this technology did not exist that long ago. So you're actually able to, in a sense, recreate a tornado on your computer screen. Can you explain a little bit how that works?
Sure. So to be clear to your listeners, I am not a field meteorologist, so I'm not chasing storms and taking data with radars and such. And that's a very important part of the whole meteorological community and the research focus. So what I'm doing, though, is I'm using supercomputers to try to simulate the atmosphere in a condition where you have these big storms. So what we do is we take the conditions that we think, you know, a loaded atmosphere that's ready to produce a big nasty supercell, and we start the model with those conditions, clear sky, no storm yet, and then we grow a storm in that environment. So we sort of perturb the atmosphere, and a cloud will start to rise and sort of frothy and bubbly like you see in the real atmosphere, and it just grows and grows. Now, we don't know what's going to happen in these simulations. So sometimes we'll do this, you know, this very elaborate simulation. We'll get a supercell and no tornado. And then we'll do it again, and we might get a weak tornado. And then what we managed to do that's significant is we managed to get one that was very similar to a storm that happened on May 24th, 2011 in Oklahoma, which was a long path. You know, the path of the storm was, you know, 50 or 60 miles. I can't remember exactly. But it was an EF5, which is the highest category of tornado. And we managed to reproduce a storm that's a lot like that one. It has the same characteristics, namely a very wide multiple vortex tornado ends up forming. It's on the ground, well, the digital ground, for a long time. And so we've been analyzing this simulation, trying to figure out what's going on. And some features have popped out that we're looking into.
Yeah, what popped out?
Well, it turns out, at least in the simulation, I don't want to give everyone the impression we've solved the problem by any means, but there's these little, you can call them like mini tornadoes, these little spinning whirls of air that are called mesocyclones that are in abundance in the simulation. And we can highlight those and view them with model data because we can look at a field of spin. We can actually plot that field. In the atmosphere, if you don't have some dust or condensation sort of stirring up with the air, you just don't see these things. So one of the things we discovered are these little vortices spinning around that kind of merge together. And apparently, right when the tornado is forming, you have a whole bunch of these just kind of coming together to sort of get this spin really going. The other thing we discovered, we gave a name, which is always a thing you take very seriously in science. You know, you come up with a new acronym or something. We call it the streamwise vorticity current. And it's really difficult to describe this on radio. But you, if you think of a rolling pin, say, on the ground, you're making bread or something, and it's rolling horizontally. So that would be the streamwise vorticity current before it gets turned up into the updraft. So essentially, you have spin in the horizontal that gets tilted into the vertical. And that's a well-known process in meteorology when you look at this term we call vorticity, which is really a measure of spin and wind shear. And it's a really interesting organization that occurs. You have this little funny SVC thing that kind of comes up and around the tornado. It doesn't actually touch it. So anyway, that's about as much as I should probably say on the air. If you know, and I do have video online and such that people can actually see these things in action.
So is this kind of new stuff, being able actually to see what's happening with the very beginning birth moments before a tornado?
Well, again, to be clear, I'm not the first person to simulate a supercell that produces a tornado. I want to be clear about that. But what we've done, the analogy I like to use is we've gone from like a 2-megapixel camera to a 20-megapixel camera. So we've gotten a whole lot sharper picture of what's going on in three dimensions in the storm. So again, it's in science, you want to be careful. We're always building upon the accomplishments of many, many people before us. But what we've done is we've managed to get our hands around the immense size of the problem and have gotten pretty good at utilizing supercomputers and handling hundreds of terabytes of data so that it doesn't sort of just crush you with the weight of the data, which is really, I've spent more time working with data and managing large amounts of data than I actually have on meteorology. So I hope for that to change now that we've got a really good simulation and we're sort of spinning up our projects.
We're talking with Lee Orff right now, an associate scientist with the Space Science and Engineering Center at UW-Madison, and he leads a lab that works with computer modeling of tornadoes to better understand how they work and why they form. And you were very clear that you're not out in the field doing this. You're in front of your computer. And we just had a big tragedy with some storm chasers being killed. There's a crash in pursuit of a tornado. I mean, is this the future of studying tornadoes and other dangerous weather events, that we do it from a safe distance with a computer model instead of being out there on the road running after a thing like that?
I have to say, it's always going to be both. You're always going to have the observational collect data from the real atmosphere approach. And that is a valid, incredibly important approach. And in fact, it's what fuels a lot of the work we do at SSEC with satellites. We're observing storms from space. When it comes to storm chasing, usually you have to get pretty close in order to get if you're a research scientist and you have like a radar on the back of your truck, you have to get within, say, a half a mile of that storm to scan it pretty well. So we're going to keep doing that. Now, I want to be clear, there's one great exception. There was a storm in May 31st, 2013, and again in Oklahoma, which actually did kill some professional storm chasers. Now, this is the first time this had ever really happened, and it was a crazy storm. It was really an anomalous storm. The tornado was 2.5 miles wide. It had tornadoes inside the tornadoes, and it was easy for someone to get lost in that. Now, that's an anomalous case. One of the issues we have today with research, field studies of tornadoes, is that in places that are around Oklahoma especially, a lot of amateurs will go out to chase storms, and they clog up the roadways, so the scientists can't get their radars in place. And this is actually a real problem. So, no, we're going to continue to do the field study approach and the observational approach. But my approach, the computer approach, is equally important in meteorology, and you'll see this in meteorology a lot. You have the theoretical modeling approach and then the observational approach, and these two approaches complement each other wonderfully. If you see something in a model and you can't find it in the atmosphere, well, you better go find it or it's probably not there. But on the flip side of that, if you identify a feature in observed data and you can't explain it theoretically, that's also a problem.
Okay, so looking at the real-life ramifications of your research, and a big one is to predict that there's a tornado that's about to happen and to warn people with the right interval of time. Too far ahead, it sounds like, they're going to ignore it, too late, and they can't scramble to safety in time. So what kind of applications are you looking for here?
Yeah, that's a huge, very good point. And in fact, a lot of research in meteorology today is being done in collaboration with sociologists, because we have to understand how people respond to things. And I always like to joke that if you think predicting the weather is hard, try predicting human activity, right? So as far as the final goal of this research is indeed to produce better forecasts, more timely forecasts, more targeted forecasts. So instead of giving a tornado watch over a county area or something like half the size of a county, we'll be able to shrink it down to a much smaller region so that people only in the path of the tornado that hasn't formed yet can be evacuated or can go to their safe space. As far as what to do if a warning occurs, like you said, if you give people too much time, they may do things that will ultimately come back to bite them. Like, oh, I'm going to go pick up my kids at school because that's, you know, very important to me. Well, what if you get stuck in traffic? And there have been very close calls with high-end tornadoes where people are stuck in the highway trying to escape, and then it's just a big traffic jam. So there's a multiple facets to this work. It's not just the scientific aspect, but also the aspect of how humans react to data when they get it and information when they get it.
Now, I want to ask you, as we start to wrap up, I understand this is something's a little personal to you, kind of a lifetime calling. You witnessed a deadly tornado. We're pretty darn close to one when you were a child. Can you tell us what happened briefly?
Well, the story I always tell my students when I was teaching, two things happened. When I was like 6 or 7 years old, my house got hit by lightning, and I saw the wires glowing and the paneling blown across and the insulation. It really was scary. A couple of years later, this would have been October 3rd, 1979, I lived in far southern Massachusetts in a town called Feeding Hills, and a tornado, a very anomalous storm. It was an F4. It went up the Connecticut River Valley through Bradley International Airport, destroyed a bunch of antique aircraft, and it's still one of the most expensive tornadoes to date. And it killed some people and destroyed a lot of property. And that tornado essentially dissipated very close to my house. Our house got some winds that were damaging. They were not tornadic winds. They were straight line winds, knocked some trees down. But that was another huge event. So I guess, yeah, I guess I was called to do this. But to be quite honest, I just love science, all science. Weather works good for me.
Mm. So interesting. Lee, thank you so much for coming on and sharing today.
And thanks for having me.
That was Lee Orff, an associate scientist with the Space Science and Engineering Center at UW-Madison. He leads a lab that works with computer modeling of tornadoes to help better understand how tornadoes work and why tornadoes form.
Coming up, we'll talk about the decision in Congress to roll back an FCC rule that would protect your internet browsing habits. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour. Tonight, a heartbroken woman has a wish come true, a homeowner gets an unwanted surprise, and a struggling temp remembers his glory days. So that's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, Congress voted this week to nullify an FCC rule that regulated how internet providers gathered and used your internet browsing data. The vote was along party lines and is expected to be signed into law by President Trump.
The move means that internet providers, think companies like AT&T and Verizon, could sell your searches and location to companies, which in turn could create highly tailored ads for their products.
Barry Orton joins us now. He's Professor Emeritus of Telecom Policy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Barry, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
Well, Congress voted to roll back this Obama-era internet privacy rule. What was the intent of the original rule?
Well, the intent of the original rule was to allow consumers' personal information that goes out over the internet, what they buy, what kinds of airline flights they get, those kinds of things, and ban that from being used commercially by internet providers. And by internet providers, we're talking about phone companies like AT&T and Verizon and cable companies like Charter and Comcast. So the idea was an FCC rule that hasn't gone into effect yet. It was in the process of being implemented. And that rule would essentially treat those providers as a screen so that they were going to force them to have their customers opt in if they wanted their information sold, rather than the current system, which lets people essentially opt out. And it's much easier to get people to opt out than it is to have them actually decide to opt in. Now, this doesn't mean that Google and Facebook aren't doing the exact same thing right now. They are tailoring your ads based on what you've been watching and what you've been looking at on your screen. And anybody who's been on Google or Facebook at any length of time knows that it's very obvious that they're getting ads that are tailored to what you've been looking at.
And, yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. Do you see any differentiation that's big enough to say, look, these are two different things, having Internet service providers have access to do this and having some platforms like Google and Facebook? Or is it pretty tantamount one to the other?
Well, I think in effect they're tantamount, but the legal aspect was that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, doesn't have any jurisdiction over Google and Facebook, but it does have jurisdiction, or it did under the scheme that they were trying to put in, over the AT&Ts and Comcast. So it's not that they didn't want to include them, it's that they didn't have the legal right to include them. So these were rules that were essentially put into effect or started in effect in the last year or so. And so they really haven't been fully implemented yet, so the fact that they're being struck down by Congress doesn't change anything for anybody. We're in the same boat we were 6 months ago or 2 years ago.
So it's not like suddenly we're going to sit down at our computer and, you know, be caught flat-footed with all kinds of sensitive work data or something, things we don't want out there. This has not gone into effect, but down the road, what sorts of side
down
effects?
Down the road, it means that anybody who has access to your information, whether it's your carrier, the people who own the wire that you're using and paying to have Internet service, or the platforms you're using like Google or Facebook, they're going to be tailoring advertising directly to you. This is very big business. Last year, Google made over $30 billion in the digital advertising business, and Facebook made $16 billion. So it's not small change, and AT&T and Comcast have been chafing at the bit to get a piece of that action. And so what this law does, incidentally, as your report says, passed on strict party lines pretty much, this will allow them to get in that same advertising business too. What ultimately that means is anything you do on the Internet, you can be pretty sure that somebody can capture and either use to sell you more products or use to invade your privacy, and there's not a whole lot anybody's going to be able to do about it.
Now, you're saying this broke down pretty much along party lines. Republicans were in favor of rolling back this rule that had not gone into effect yet.
Yes.
But so politically, what was the argument there for politically and also business-wise from Republicans about why this was the choice they wanted to make?
Well, the argument was twofold. One, it was started by Democrats, and they didn't like that. It was started by FCC chairman who used the Democrat majority on the commission to push it through. And second, they don't like the bigger scheme of the Internet being regulated in any way, shape, or form by federal agencies. They're not happy about that. And this is part of a whole bigger scheme called net neutrality. And that was another FCC law that went into effect in 2016. In 15, rather, and it was upheld in the courts in 2016. And that said that the Internet was like a public utility, and so it should be regulated like telephone is regulated, rather than as an information service like Facebook or Google. And so Republicans generally don't, and the industries that support them generally didn't like that either. So this is one part of a larger dismantling of what had been set up over the last few years under a Democratic administration.
So is it your best guess that net neutrality will be the next to fall and to change course on this?
Net neutrality and the idea that Internet services are treated under what's called Title II, Roman number two, like telephone is, where there are rights of privacy, where there are public utility-like regulation that protects consumers, that also will be on the in the crosshairs of the Republican administration and the Republican Congress.
Barry Orton is with us right now. He's Professor Emeritus of Telecom Policy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we're talking about the House vote that would get rid of an FCC rule that prevents your internet service provider from selling your browsing habits.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on this rule? Never quite into effect, now apparently on the way out, pending the president's signature. Do you worry about your privacy online? Do you worry that the things you search for, the emails you send, the data you collect, the data you leave can form a trail that can be used to market products to you? Or are you not worried about that? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about a recent vote in the House that would strike down an FCC rule preventing your internet service provider from selling your browsing data to companies looking to market products to you. And we're talking with Barry Orton about this news. He's Professor Emeritus of Telecom Policy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Are you for or against rolling back this rule? Looks like it's on the way out, pending White House approval. Are you worried about your privacy when you go online? The paper trail, the virtual paper trail you leave when you browse online, maybe shopping, maybe for health information, you name it. Do you want that info out there and sold to marketers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We take a caller now. We've got Jason joining us in Wausau. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how are you guys? Thanks for taking my call. So I actually own a high-speed internet business. It's a pretty small network. We're a provider that kind of aims to help the rural areas where they can't get access to good data. And I have just a couple thoughts on this. First, I'm against rolling this rule back and the idea that net neutrality should be in any way compromised, just in the sense that consumers really aren't going to win here. I feel like there could be some sort of alteration to this that more or less allowed or required ISPs that are going to profit from this information to reinvest some of that money into their networks. You know, because right now you've got a lot of big companies and corporations that won't expand into the rural areas because of, you know, the economics behind that situation. And so this seems like a good opportunity to at least help the customers in those areas to maybe have a better experience. You know, if you're going to pay for the data, they're going to sell your browsing history and just walk away with that cash. I feel like the legislative bodies need to do something to force the hand with the expansion to at least get the experience for customers on a better level. I don't personally think that I would ever take my customers' information that trust me with their internet usage and sell that to somebody. I just morally, to me, it's just wrong as somebody in the industry.
Jason, thank you so much for that call. Interesting point there, Jason, thinking that the profits that are garnered from whatever sort of advertising, marketing money that could be made from these ISPs, some of that should go back to benefit the communities. Some people, for instance, in Wisconsin, maybe, who may not have good internet access.
I wouldn't be holding my breath waiting for that to happen.
Yeah, and so what do you think is going to happen with these profits? It's business.
It goes to the bottom line of Comcast and AT&T. There's not going to be any quid pro quo that's going to make the companies who profit from our privacy plow that back into giving us better service.
Well,
that's not going to happen in my lifetime.
Do consumers have any leverage with this? I mean,
not really. They have very little leverage, actually. AT&T and Comcast are going to do what they want to do for their bottom line. And if consumers don't like it, they can, A, not shop online and not do searches and so on health issues and things that they don't want others to deal with. In some ways, you are going to have more privacy by picking up the phone and talking to someone about your purchases or about your health issue than you would by filling out forms online or searching. And that's ironic, but old media, i.e. telephones, are still protected, and our privacy is still protected by a considerably larger amount than it is online. We are anonymous sometimes online, or at least we think we are, so we can say things we might not want to say on the telephone or directly to a person. But that anonymity is just really a ephemera. It's not real.
And Barry, what about VPNs? I guess this is virtual provider networks. Some people are saying this is one way to go if you want to try to safeguard privacy.
There's a lot of different technical ways you can encrypt. You can have virtual private networks, all that kind of thing. There's always ways to get around that. But quite frankly, that's you're really going to be not going to be guaranteeing privacy. If you want to keep stuff private, you don't put it out on the Internet.
Jason, thanks so much for that call. Appreciate it. And we go next to Neil in Madison. Neil, hi.
Hello.
How would you want to share?
I think the view that this data is going to be used exclusively for marketing is an incredibly narrow view of this. Since, you know, they'll sell the data to basically anybody who will buy it, I can see things happening like, your employer wants to know what you've been looking at. The political parties want to know what you're looking at, and so on.
Absolutely right.
So the idea that this is all about marketing is really not looking far enough at what could be done with this.
Barry, you're agreeing with this. What do you see as the frontiers of how this data could be used?
Well, I agree it can be used and will be used politically. And those who worry about the United States becoming a more fascist country in terms of having authoritarian rule, these would be tools that can be used very easily to see what other kinds of activities, political and otherwise, people are doing. And so I didn't want to imply that marketing and money is the only reason to be worried about this, but that's the first and most obvious reason. But the others are even scarier, and I'm probably in denial about them.
What do you think about the argument that rolling back this rule fosters innovation and gives consumers, you got at this before a little bit, but ads that are more relevant to their lives instead of something random that has no bearing?
It is more innovative to show me an advertisement for something that I've recently searched for rather than a random advertisement. Similarly, it's innovation to show me an ad politically if I've been active politically, but I'm not sure that's innovation that really takes us in the right direction.
Well, Neil, thank you for that call. Another quick one here from David in Delavan. David, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to maybe throw out there sort of a question, and it seems that everybody's kind of buying into this as being about advertising, and I'm just curious, sort of a white elephant in the room thing. We all know, or most of us, or whatever the percentages know, that the government and big business go hand in hand. And it seems to be, you know, being touted to us that it's all about, you know, what pair of socks you might want to buy, or if this canoe is a better value than that one. But I don't know that anybody really trusts anymore the idea that the more information about you that these big businesses can get is a good thing.
David, thanks for that, and short of time, so Barry, your response.
I guess I'm agreeing. I don't like to start looking at the worst possible scenarios, but yes, government control of this kind of information is possible, and this can increase the possibility. And to just put your listeners off in the same direction slightly further, it's just been announced today that AT&T has gotten a very large federal contract to do a large national public safety network for first responders. And so there will be a direct link between AT&T and law enforcement. They're going to be providing the network that law enforcement uses on a national basis.
And Barry, a couple seconds here. Is President Trump going to sign this? This is
absolutely
a sure thing.
They've announced today, Sean Spicer at his press conference said that they're all in favor of it. So there's no doubt that it'll be signed. It passed the Senate by party lines, passed the House by party lines. I can't imagine any scenario where he doesn't sign it.
Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Barry Orton, Professor Emeritus of Telecom Policy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, joining us there to talk about the House vote that would roll back an FCC rule that was put into place to keep Internet service providers from selling your Internet browsing data.
Now, our next installment in our year-long series called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. American dairy cows are producing more milk than they ever have, but as the amount of milk goes up, the number of cows is actually going down. Bridget Bowden has more on how that happens and what it means for the dairy industry.
Last year, the average American dairy cow produced more than 22,000 pounds of milk. In Waldo, Wisconsin, there's a cow that produced more than three times that, setting the national record for milk production. She belongs to Tom Kestel of Evergreen View Farm. She shattered the record by producing more than 77,000 pounds of milk in 1 year. That's enough to fill an Olympic swimming pool. Kestel says she's a pretty typical cow for his herd.
As you can see, she just stands in a stall just like everybody else. No special treatment.
Kestel says the secret to getting his cows to produce so much milk is good breeding. He makes about two-thirds of his income breeding the high-producing cows and then selling their genes all over the world.
That is certainly not part of our goal at all, is to set a new national record in anything. Our goal is to take care of our cows, breed good cows, have good cows, sell good cows to other people.
Kestel's champion cow is an extreme example, but average milk per cow has shot up since 1950. Today, we have less than half as many dairy cows as we did then, but they produce almost twice as much milk. Mark Stevenson is the director for dairy policy analysis at the UW Center for Dairy Profitability. He says the introduction of artificial insemination is one of the reasons for this huge rise in milk production.
We went from natural breeding of cows to artificial insemination of cows, and that let us have better genetic selection of animals than just, you know, what your best-looking bull out of the herd it used to be.
He says better nutrition and management have contributed to the spike in milk production, as well as vaccines and the controversial growth hormone RBST, which makes cows produce more milk.
No question that that is efficacious. A cow will produce more milk if provided that product. But increasingly, consumers have been pushing away from that, and there's much less used of that product today.
And within the last decade, there was another development that changed the industry. The bovine genome was sequenced and published in 2009. Since then, breeding cows based on the properties contained in their DNA has been on the rise.
Before we could take a look right into the DNA, we were changing the DNA of the cattle. We were selecting bulls who had certain performance.
That's Ryan Starkenberg. He's the senior geneticist for ABS Global, a large artificial insemination company based in DeForest. He says one of the problems with high production cows is they sometimes have trouble with reproducing, but with genomics, they can try to breed that out.
We can actually select for cows that are better milk producers as well as more reproductively efficient and can breed back more easily, calve more easily, and so on. So those animals are hard to find. But once we find them, we can then use the artificial breeding to really spread their genes around the country and around the world.
Tom Kestel, who owns the Champion Cow, has sold genetics in dozens of countries. He says he's seen the dairy industry change a lot since he started milking cows in the 1950s.
But yet, still the same goal is the same, is to be able to produce milk as cheaply and economically as you can, without sacrificing the well-being of the cow.
And he says he expects it to keep changing and milk production to keep going up. And it needs to, as worldwide dairy consumption is also on the rise. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is part of a year-long reporting project at WPR called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. Find stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Ideas Network, and online at WPR.org/change.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a Wisconsin healthcare policy expert joins the show for a look at what happens to Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, after the failed congressional effort to repeal and replace it.
A physicist tries to help us understand why we exist and what our place is in the universe.
And on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll get some inspiration from across the Pacific Ocean. We'll talk to the author of the new cookbook, Let's Cook Japanese. And I got to say, this is a genre of cooking, except for buying a jar of teriyaki sauce at the store, I know nothing about. This will be a learning experience for me.
And I made, we tried to make some sushi and ended up basically covered in rice with little balls of seaweed.
Yeah. We all have a lot to learn coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow after 6, it's a spring edition of Tell Joy Where to Go. Travel expert Gary Knowles shares some great springtime destinations and events from all over Wisconsin. You can call in with some of your favorites, too. That's tomorrow morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then we look at a growing spat between Governor Walker and state GOP lawmakers over his budget's impact on transportation funding and taxes. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.